painting to photography, from beadwork to woodworking. KQAL-FM on the campus of Winona State University presents Artbeat. Artbeat highlights the work and accomplishments of local artists from in and around Winona. Support for Artbeat is made possible by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.
Last week on Artbeat, we featured our interview with Jim Tittle, conducted during Frozen River Film Festival. Jim started out as a photographer and moved into video camera work. He is also known for installation art. Today, we pick up the conversation on the subject of filming and his documentary, The Price of Sand. You're listening to Artbeat with Terry Tunseth. So then you get involved in narrative, right?
Well, I've always been. Narrative has always interested me quite a bit. And in fact, that was one of the problems when I was a student at the College of Art and Design is that, I have a sense of form, but I always seem to want to get a story out of something or make a story into it. And with the pictures, the idea of using figures was imply a narrative and then see what people say. Tell me what you see. It's like a Rorschach.
Yeah.
Right. So objects and pictures that I've made have always had an implied story.
Well, it makes sense to go into video then.
Right. Well, yes, it did. And in fact, I thought, well, really, I do photography. That's usually how I make money, is something with a camera.
Right.
So why not try to become, direct commercials or get into film? So that was my switch, as I thought, well, maybe I can get into shooting spots, something that pays well. Because really, that's kind of, if you can't make enough money to live on your art, or if you don't want to compromise enough to make the money, make your living on your art, then find some way to get the most bang out of the most money back for your time.
Right.
TV commercials pay a lot.
Yeah.
So I thought, well, I could do that. I'm sure a lot of us think that.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. But it became more complicated. And finally, what I realized is that I'm not really suited. I went running and screaming from the ad agency. So what business did I have? Jesus, that was stupid. So I ended up buying a Betacam,
I borrowed
some money. I bought a Betacam and I started shooting corporate stuff, which is a lot more sane. Sometimes it can get boring. Anything could get, shooting a Pampers commercial could get boring too, I suppose.
How many diapers can you look at?
Right.
Right.
Exactly.
So you do corporate, but
well,
then...
I do whatever pays me.
Yeah, I understand. Yeah. But now you've got this film, The Price of Sand.
Time-lapse, too, as a matter of fact.
Yeah, and I've seen your time-lapse stuff.
Have you seen some time-lapse stuff?
Yeah.
That was a funny thing. I got a call from a guy, a client of mine who'd worked at a corporate department, and he'd moved a couple of times to different jobs. And one day he calls me up and he says, Jim, you do time-lapse? And I went, Paul, I'm really sorry I don't. He says, well, you could probably do it. And I said, yeah, I could figure that out. He says, well, we got this thing. We need a bid on a 18-month time-lapse of our headquarters. We're building a new headquarters in downtown St. Paul. We're going to tear down a city block. I said, well, really? And he goes, yeah, just figure it out, do a bid on it, and see if you get it. And I don't know. I think he put in a good word for me, but I got it. So then I had to go out and, what a Mitchell camera is?
Yeah.
It's the funniest thing. I started reading about it, because this is like 1998, 1999. So there was the internet. And I'm reading about time-lapse, and I realized that there's this guy in L.A. He's gotten an Academy Award for his time-lapse. Norris. You ever see a Norris time-lapse controller?
I don't think I've seen that.
Well, the guy got an Academy Award for the equipment that he built.
Developed for it?
Yeah. So I looked him up, and I called, and Mr. Norris answered the phone. And he talked to me for like 2 hours.
That's awesome.
All these tips and gave me a list of people to call. He says, well, a camera you ought to use is a Mitchell 16. And so then I called this guy in Northern California who reconditions Mitchell 16. Says, yeah, I got a couple old ones. I can sell those to you. And got all the gear, figured it all out, tested it, set it up in Landmark Center, built this rig, and shot 18 months of 16-millimeter film, made some money. And now every year, I get a few long-term jobs. Right now I'm doing one for XL, two of them for XL Energy. I'm doing one in Becker, Minnesota, and another one out in Granite City or Granite Falls, Minnesota. Yeah, and I did some for the History Channel. I did one once. We called it Stinky for Monster Quest. It was the first job I did for Monster Quest. And they called me up. It's the same thing. Do you think you can?
Yeah.
Well, why not? And it was, they wanted to show that when Bigfoot dies, the reason we never find a Bigfoot out in the forest is because he decays. When something dies, it disappears. So that was the idea. And they said, well, let's do it with a deer carcass. So there I am in July. I build this tower and this camera housing and everything out in the woods. We peg this deer carcass down to the ground, and I do a time lapse of it decaying. Can you imagine how that smelled?
It's disgusting after 3 days, isn't it?
This is July.
Oh, then that's even faster.
It was nasty. Oh. So we called them stinky, but it worked. It worked well. There's a wolf research center just north of the Twin Cities, and they had some property, and one of the guys knew this woman, so we were able to use that. And the cool thing about the wolf center is they're in a big pen, you know, behind chain link, but like coyotes and things stay away. So we had the deer carcass close enough so that really the only thing that came in and what got rid of the deer carcass was flies and insects.
Yeah.
It
larva
looked like, it looked like somebody had poured a bag of popcorn on top of Stinky, and then the popcorn moves, and then eventually Stinky dissolves into some blackened bones.
I've seen some of these. Mm-hmm. There's actually documentaries about corpse farms, mm-hmm. too.
Never seen one, but yeah.
Yeah, I think there's one on Netflix right now. And my husband's like, why would you want to watch that? And I'm like, because it's kind of cool to see stuff like time lapse. I don't know.
That was my entry into cryptozoology, which I'd never heard of before.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, cryptozoology. I didn't even know that was a word. And then I found myself sleeping in a leaky tent on Mount St. Helens with a group of women who are trying to attract Bigfoot with their scent.
Weird.
Yes.
But fascinating.
And fascinating. And I came to Winona for a gig with them. Mothman.
Yeah.
Yeah, shot the Mothman episode.
Yeah.
Yes, we were down here in Trempealeau County.
I heard about that happening. Yeah. Uh-huh.
Yeah, that was us. We were here.
God.
Yeah, yeah. And also Sacramento, there was and West Virginia. So I'd travel around with that and shoot low budget TV, spooky
reality docu style.
Yeah, open helicopters.
Type things.
Yeah.
Helicopters, that'd be fun.
Yeah, there was one. They took us out, Bluff Creek, the Patterson film. You must have seen that with Bigfoot walking down the creek.
Mm-hmm.
The idea was some sort of an anniversary. That was in the 60s, and this is in the 40 years later or whatever. So we went out to Bluff Creek with these people, and we were going to go to the exact site, and they were going to do some kind of survey. It was pretty technical. But the whole idea was we were going to fly in. So we got this helicopter, a Robinson R-44, one of those four-seaters. It was going to fly us in. It's mountainous there. It's like mountains. And they sent Bobo, he was our guide, this guy Bobo, up in the helicopter with a helicopter pilot to go check first. Turns out nobody had checked the weather or the snow cover. Nobody had done any research on this. There's too much snow. You can't land a helicopter there.
Oh, no.
That time of year. Yeah. So we brought the whole crew out there and everything, and there we are stuck. So then I had to go up in the helicopter with Bobo and the pilot and shoot enough cover so we could explain in the story why we couldn't land the helicopter, right? So we're flying around. I'm getting this stuff. And I said to the pilot, well, can we land on like a ridge or something so we can show the snow? And the guy says, okay. So we land on this ridge, and he puts the helicopter down, and it's up to the belly, and it's sitting like an egg in the snow. And I get out, and I'm up to my hips carrying this camera, and I wait a while because he's going to take off and then land again. So I get the shot of them landing and looking, oh, there's too much snow to land, and then taking off. You want the landing and the taking
off.
Well, so they did all that, and it all worked. We get back that night, and we're sitting around, having dinner and having a beer. And I said to the pilot was doing this on a lark. He was a rescue pilot who was doing this for fun to be on TV. And I said, so was that dangerous landing in that snow like that? He says, yeah, that's why it took me a minute before I decided to do it. And I said, why? What's dangerous? And he says, well, if you don't land just right, you flip the helicopter.
Nice to know.
He didn't want to tell me that at the time.
Right. And yeah. I'm glad you're Thanks. Probably glad you didn't know.
Didn't want to know. That's the thing I learned about helicopter pilots is that they will tell you when you're in the air, you're flying along, the door is off the helicopter, your feet are hanging out, and you're looking down. They'll tell you stories about their friend that crashed into the power lines or the guy that flipped. Yeah.
I do that. My husband says it's easier to ask for forgiveness later.
Right. Yeah, that's called sin immunity.
Yeah.
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 Yeah. I've worked on the sin immunity principle.
So tell us about how you came to start working on The Price of Sand, which is now your current project. No, well,
okay.
We got to the video portion.
Oh, you got to video. Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, almost 2 years ago, it was, I think, April. I've told this story many times now because everybody asked me this.
Well, yeah.
It's like a politician's stump speech, but okay.
Give it to me.
Okay, I'll give it to you. My brother calls me up. He does not call me that often. He lives in Red Wing. He's got a family. He moved back there, and he sells real estate. But he's kind of an unusual real estate salesman. He's kind of a, he does well at it, but he's an outdoor guy.
He's not your hard salesman type?
No, yeah, no, okay. He's just a mellow guy. He's okay. A good guy, and he loves the outdoors a lot. And they live just outside of town, and my mom lives nearby too. Anyhow, he calls me up, and he says, Jim, I thought you ought to know that the property just past mom's over there, just been sold. Well, I own some land too.
Okay.
There. And I think that's why he was telling me. But the thing is, this property is 150 acres. They sold it for $2.6 million.
It's a lot of money.
Yeah, considering, what did he tell me? That normally it would go for like 300 and some thousand.
Right, right.
It went for $2.6
million. Wow.
Well, because he's in real estate, first of all, the sale had happened months before and he didn't know about it. And this is in his own backyard. Okay?
Yeah.
Small town. Realtor doesn't know that his own neighborhood, they've sold this land for a lot of money.
And all the realtors talk to each other.
Right. Right. This was all under the radar. So he started asking around and he found out that it had been purchased by an oil company. Well, my mom had heard about this too and everybody was talking about it. People were going, well, is there oil here? Well, interesting thing about John is John has a degree in geology.
Oh.
Right.
That's handy.
And he got that because he loves geology. He likes rocks and stuff.
So why not?
Yeah. He got it because he thought he would become a geologist. But when he finished college, there were no jobs in geology. So, he got into selling houses. But point is, he knew right away that there's no oil. There's no gas in Goodhue County. There never will be. So a little more research, and he found out that they wanted the sand. And then the question was for what? And again, luckily he understands this stuff, but so by the time he called me, he kind of knew what was going on. And then the question for us was, so how come 2 years ago when the guy who owned that property wanted to have a rifle range there, zoning wouldn't let him do that because of the noise. But now this oil company can come in and have an open pit mine and that's okay?
Strange.
Yeah. It seemed very strange. It made me upset, really. I mean, I just thought, okay, I don't know anything about hydraulic fracturing. I don't really know much about mining, but I do know about things that are inappropriate, and this seems really, really inappropriate.
Yeah.
And the fact that they paid so much money means that they're using their muscle. You know what I mean?
What you mean.
If that much money means nothing to them, and they haven't even cleared it with the neighbors, then it means they're prepared to use some very heavy muscle to do this.
Well, it's frightening.
Well, it is. Yeah, and so I admit, I was pretty pissed off, and I thought, I'd already worked as a volunteer. I made a series of videos for a political campaign for a senator a few years before that, and those worked. They helped. I know they helped his campaign. They were effective, and I thought, YouTube is free. I'm just going to see if I can find some information about these sand mines and put them up online. Go talk to people who live next to them or, whatever. So I went to Le Sueur, Minnesota, because I looked online and found there are only two silica mines in Minnesota. Well, really three. There was one down in near Lanesboro that was just a little farm thing. But there's the big Uniman mine in Ottawa, which is actually right near Le Sueur. And then there's Preferred Sands, I think it is, in Woodbury. And the Woodbury mine, it was from Google Earth. It looked like I couldn't get much of a shot. So I went down to the big Uniman mine to have a look. And there's some footage of that in my film. Couldn't see much. Big berm, but it was huge. And it kind of freaked me out. So then after that, I found out that in Wisconsin, there was a lot of this going on. I went over to Wisconsin, and one thing led to another. And after I'd made about 20 little short videos, I thought I should make a full-length film. Which is probably a crazy thing to do because it's basically been my entire life for the last year and a half.
Yeah, but you love what you do, right?
Yeah, I do. I do. I like hearing people. Obviously, here I am talking. I love telling stories. I also like learning new stories. And the sad thing is that the stories that I heard, there are some really depressing stories. People that are really stuck next to these things. Or like, there's this woman I met, and the minute I met her, I thought, this lady is great. You know, she's in her 60s. She's got her farm here. She's raising beef cattle. She's full of vitality. And she's got asthma because they built an enormous sand mine across the road.
That might have something to do with it.
Yeah. I mean, it's making her sick, and she's got to leave or face the consequences. And by the end of the afternoon, I was wheezing and coughing too.
So how do you go about filming this? I mean, you're gaining information for yourself, right?
Right.
Right.
Well, but I'm trying to also, when I decided to do the, normally, well, you know, I mean,
yeah.
you've been in this business, so you know how it works. What you do is you do a little trailer, and then you go out and you try and get money.
Yeah.
You get money, and maybe, you know, in this case, I worked up a budget, and I thought, you know, if I could get about 36 grand, I could pull favors, I could, you know, hire an editor at way cut rate, and I could do this thing. Because I own cameras, you know.
Right.
So get all that done. but really, then I looked at it and went, but my hard costs is going to be gas and the occasional hotel and meals. Because you don't want to go, you go bumming rooms from people and you get all into stuff. You want to be able to go rent a cheap hotel room somewhere, you know.
Yeah.
And you want to be somewhere for a day or two. You don't want to just go there for a couple hours. You want to have flexibility to, because somebody says, you know, you ought to talk to my neighbor. You want to be able to do that. You don't want to. And I learned that shooting for the History Channel. You get there and you go have lunch at a cafe and people say, what are you doing? You say, well, we're making a show about Bigfoot. And they go, oh, my uncle saw Bigfoot last week. You want to go follow up on that.
And one thing leads to another.
Right,
leads to
exactly.
Another, leads
so
to
in
another.
A perfect world.
Right.
And I realized, and the other thing is, you know, with the recession, my business was down. I had some extra time. I'm not starving, but I had more time than I normally do. So I thought, well, okay, I've got something that means something to me. So bottom line is I wanted money for gas, which is ironic since the frac sand is used for oil, which is gas. So, but I wanted to raise some money so I could defray that cost. So that's where I found out about crowdsourcing.
Yes, Indiegogo.
Mm-hmm. We did an Indiegogo. I got some help, made up a website and a Facebook page, and did a crowdsourcing campaign on Indiegogo. And the idea was to raise $5,600 in 56 days, and to do that over Christmas last year.
I remember this.
You know, a couple people said, that's crazy. You know, you wait till spring, because first of all, over Christmas, nobody's going to give you money. Second of all, $5,600 ain't chicken scratch, especially on Indiegogo during a recession. Actually, it wasn't easy, but I had some help from some people, and we raised $6,800.
That's a lot.
It was, yes. I mean, you pay some fees to Indiegogo.
Well, of course, yeah.
I had a guy who was helping me, and I had to give him a small percentage of what I did because he was doing some of the heavy lifting. But I came out of it with enough money to buy some hard drives and pay for my gas and lodging.
So you were able to keep going. And
yeah, exactly.
My question
There's
is...
There's still an issue of I can't shoot when a job comes in.
Right.
You know, a client calls and says, we've got a job for you. Well, I've got to cancel whatever I'm doing on my documentary because I still have to pay my mortgage.
Well, yeah, we have priorities, right?
Unfortunately,
unfortunately,
yes.
In this world.
Plus, you know, I mean, our daughter headed off to college this year, so you've got to have a graduation party. You know, there are things you have to, you can't say, well, we'll do that party next year.
No.
You know, so
I can imagine your daughter wouldn't like that either.
Yeah, she's pretty understanding, but.
Oh, wow. Well,
yeah.
So my question for you is, while you're making this film, how do you do a disconnect so you're making sure you're getting all the information you need? You know, I mean, like, there's emotional things that go mm-hmm. into this. I mean, you feel for the people,
yeah.
But at the same time, you have to kind of separate yourself to make sure that you're getting what you need.
Mm-hmm. Well, trying to frame that question. What I did early on is I started asking, okay, so, you know, what are the big issues here? And right away, one of the surprising ones that comes up is trucking. It takes a lot of trucks to haul that sand, and that has ramifications. So, okay, I want to talk to people about how is this impacting your life? Dust. Okay, is this dust dangerous?
Or is it not?
Or is it not?
Yeah.
Right. The mining industry is saying it's not dangerous. Don't worry about it. But other people are saying, God, it's going to kill you. And I didn't at that point even know. I mean, I hadn't even really seen any of the dust. And then there's issues of jobs. This is great This is the greatest thing in the world. This is going to create all these jobs. It's going to be great. But then you talk to people and they say, well, have you ever been to a mining town? Just go look at a mining town and tell me, an old mining town, tell me, is their economy great? Is that town doing good? If you've been to a mining town, you know what I'm talking about. So basically, I had these questions, and I just started to look for people who might be able to tell me stories about how they had been affected that would relate to these questions. Does that make sense?
That makes sense. You got to look at the actual variables.
Right.
And then you have to go over, get the information about those variables.
Right. So I was, the information I wanted, people, you know, would send me statistics and things. What I've been interested in is actual stories, like firsthand stories, because you can always find an activist or a specialist who will tell you, give you a summary, you know, and you can find all sorts of things in print. But what I wanted was to know what happened to you, because I think that's the most compelling.
It's engaging, too.
Right. Right. So I was looking for firsthand experiences that I could record. In a perfect world, I would have had a cameraman with me all the time.
Right.
And we could shoot it that way. Unfortunately, I had people that volunteered, but working with their schedules and varying levels of experience got to be really difficult. And I wasn't able to get into situations I wanted to get into as fast. You know, it's like, this person can only talk to me Sunday at 1 o'clock, but nobody's available Sunday at 1 o'clock to help me. So I just go do it. So I did have helpers on and off, but the bulk of the project I had to shoot myself. And the limiting factor there is, if you want a story, the best way to get it really is to sit someone down, get comfortable with them, and just talk. But if you want to make an interesting story, you'd rather have them hang gliding while they're telling you the story.
Oh, yeah.
You know, or feeding their cows or whatever. But the fact is, if you're shooting it alone and trying to talk to them, you want to stick your camera down on your sticks, keep the lighting to a minimum, slap the mic on them, and just say, okay, let her rip.
Right.
Tell me the story. So that was my technique.
And it seems to have done very well for you, actually.
I don't know. You know, I got holes, and I'm still working on trying to make it as good a film as I can. It's not done. But I do have some stories that really surprised me. For instance, I was looking for footage of trucks because I'd heard a ton of stories about how bad the truck traffic was. Well, okay, tell me, but then I got to see it. You know, I got to have an image of this. I can't just have you telling me the truck traffic sucks. I mean, if you tell me there's 500 trucks a day, I can't even visualize that. That seems crazy. That's got to be an exaggeration, right? You're blowing smoke. But I went out to a place and I saw that kind of volume. You know, I mean, I was able to actually find that. And when I found that place, I'm standing there in the ditch with my tripod and these big trucks are going by. They're looking at me and they're on their CB radios. I know they're talking to each other about this guy. Half an hour worth of shooting this. And then I went over to my car, which is parked in this little parking lot at the town hall right there. And I'm in my car getting another battery and another memory card. And one of those trucks peels off from the line and pulls up right next to me.
Hmm.
Now, I've already heard stories about truckers with baseball bats.
Really?
I've gotten emails from these guys because I've got YouTube videos up. Emails saying, you know, if you don't like it, get out and walk. You know, or another one said something like, a truck brought you your food. A truck brought you the gas for your car. You know, what do you got against truckers? I mean, I get these nasty emails from truckers. And I thought, I better watch out. I'm out here all alone. Here's this guy with a funny look on his face getting out of his truck, coming right at me.
I'm sure your wife feels great about that.
And one strange part is I'm thinking, should I be pointing a camera at him?
Right.
But the other thing you realize right away is when you point a camera at somebody, it really is a weapon.
It disarms people.
Well, it also pisses them off.
Oh, yeah.
It can do both. And really, if a stranger is coming up to you, I think if you want to be friendly, you have to basically turn the camera away. You point a camera at him, it's really like pointing a gun at him. So I left the camera on in the seat because I wanted to leave a record for posterity in case my body ended up in a ditch.
You got the audio at least, right?
Yeah. And, you know, we started to talk. And he said, what are you doing out here? And I said, well, I'm making a documentary. And he said, really? For who? And I said, well, it's independent. I don't know. You know, whoever. He says, you think it'll be on Wisconsin Public Television? And I said, I don't know. I hope. And he said, well, you know, I watch a lot of documentaries. And it turns out Steve is a truck driver. He's based in New Auburn. And he feels like his whole industry is getting a really bad rap. We talked a bit and he said, I think I might be able to talk to you. I got a friend. We might be able to talk to you.
Oh, good.
And so I gave him my card And then I drove back to St. Paul, which is about 2.5 hours. And I got a call. It was Andy. And Andy said, yeah, you know, I'm going hunting this, you know, tomorrow, but I'm going to come back. And, you know, if you want to come back over, we'll talk to you. So I went over, drove over there and met these guys at a BP, guys I'd never really met. And we went over to their backyard and I talked to them for a couple hours. They're great guys. You know, I mean, you really want them to have a good life. And you got to respect Steve. He was out of work for a year, and he was working at a plastics factory there, making plastic tablecloths, and they laid him off because of the recession. He's unemployed. He's got kids. There's no jobs. He's screwed. And then he finds out his friend Andy's driving truck, and he starts riding with Andy, and he finds out that there's going to be this mining boom in New Auburn. He basically gets all the credit he can, all the credit, you know, hawks everything he's got, and he buys a truck and gets work hauling sand. And now he's solvent.
So there's two sides of it.
Oh, absolutely. Definitely. Another guy. And so Steve and Andy are in my film. And the point Steve makes is he says, you know, it's your land. You can do what you want with it. I mean, and that's an attitude a lot of people have. I disagree with that, but I understand where those people are coming from. They see this as their right. You know, you can have a sand mine. You can do whatever you want. Well, anyhow, another interesting one. I was in Alma. And again, this is a luxury you have when you're shooting your own documentary. You have no crew to worry about. It's like, I can
you're on your timetable.
As long as I can afford, you know, my $50 a night motel room and eat some peanuts, I can stay here. It's real cheap once I'm here. So I was in Alma, and it was really hot. It was nasty, and I was trying to arrange some interviews and stuff. And I went up to this park, Buena Vista Park.
Yeah, I know that.
Way up there, you know, on the bluff, just to get some cover shots of Alma and the river.
Nice B-roll.
And yeah, exactly. And I've got my camera set up on the tripod, and there are people milling around up there taking pictures. And this guy comes up, and he says, what are you doing? I said, oh, I'm making a documentary.
Again? Well, wow. Right. This is like the popular question with you,
well,
isn't it?
Always, well, anybody. You pull out a big camera, and you put it on a tripod, and people want to know.
Right.
So anyhow, it turns out this guy's on the Chippewa County Board.
Oh, how convenient.
And he has opinions. And when I tell him about the frac sand thing, he's, oh, you know, like we're going to have a fight or something. And I'm like, no, I want to hear what you got to say. And he says, well, you'll see this in my film too. He says, you know, I was in Vietnam and basically war is hell. I mean, he went through some stuff in Vietnam that was pretty awful. And he came back and that was pretty awful. It was just a really bad thing. And then now he sees all these kids going off to war. And he says, you know, I'm not a fool. I know why these wars are started. It's over oil. And if we can get our own energy here, well, then those kids don't have to go out there. So, hey, take all the sand you want. That's what he said. And I said, geez, you know, that's pretty powerful. And I think I should show that argument. But I know, you know, you're on the county board and you probably don't want to be. He says, well, you were recording me right now, weren't you? And I went, no, I wouldn't do that. I wouldn't record you secretly. I can't use it anyhow.
Right.
I need a release, you know. And he says, oh, well, you know, I could say that. That's my own opinion. So I turned the camera on him, and he said it all again.
So some people will surprise you.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. You know, in all sorts of ways. That's the fun thing about it. Very nice man. I have another interview with a man. He's a retired attorney. He's also on the county board of Pierce County. And he refutes that in a very eloquent way. He just points out that really what we're seeing is the work of, well, it's speculators, basically. A lot of the energy is being shipped overseas. This isn't really about America's energy independence. This is about large corporations making as much money as they can as fast as they can. At least that's the opinion that I favor.
So you do have your own opinion, but at the same time,
have
you have
opinion.
To,
very
you know,
well,
have your balance.
I'm not making, I don't have the resources to make a full-blown, like a TV documentary.
Right.
It has, for one thing, because of my fundraising, I didn't get a lot of funding from like the sand mines. You know, when I went on Indiegogo.
Yeah, I wouldn't
think
so.
I got funding from people that are pissed off at sand mining.
Right.
And my YouTube channel, all the content there is basically telling you that maybe sand mining isn't so good, you know? So the sand industry became aware of me, I'm sure, well over a year ago. Because again, in the Twin Cities, we all, guys in my business, we all know each other. And I know, for instance, that, let's just say that they know they're aware of my film. They've been aware of my film for
gotcha.
A long time, okay?
Yeah.
And I know that also, You know, when you do a political campaign, you hire media experts to tell you how to position yourself and how to run your campaign. You know about that,
yeah.
Right? Okay, the general public may still be sketchy on that. But basically, it's like having an ad agency for your political campaign.
Well, you kind of have to.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, newsflash, the sand business here has those resources and is using them very effectively. So if you want to hear all the good things about sand mining, you don't really have to hear them from my little independent film. I mean, I'm trying to show not what PR companies will tell you, but what actual people will tell you. And I do have a few people in the film who are speaking in favor of this, but I think most of the voices in my film are opposed.
Well, I think you can find more opposed from just, you know,
right.
From what I've encountered being in the media.
The people that are in favor of the frac sand mining don't usually see any need to talk to an independent filmmaker for whatever reason. Now, I have filmed some things at public meetings. That's fair game, where people get up to a microphone and they give you their take on it. Yeah, there's plenty of that.
So what's the end goal then?
Of the film?
Of the film and for you.
The end goal. The goal of the film is to, I guess, I don't think that anyone will look at my film, any intelligent person will look at my film and buy everything hook, line, and sinker. You know,
yeah.
if you're smart, you take your information from a variety of sources. What I'm trying to do is give you some sources you wouldn't normally have. Show you some actual stories of real people who are dealing with this big boom, and you listen to them, you weigh them, and maybe you'll change your perspective, or maybe you'll gain a perspective that you wouldn't normally have. That's what I'm thinking.
Yeah.
Sure, I'd love to be able to wave a magic wand and stop silica mining. But on the other hand, I don't know if I really would, because I have a house with glass windows. I brush my teeth with toothpaste. There's silica in all of that. So it's really more a question of proportion. Where is this appropriate? How should it be done? And what I'm afraid of right now is that it's not being done in an appropriate way, and it's being done, a lot of people are being hurt. And there's also, in some cases, there's irreparable damage being done to the environment. I know I'm not supposed to say environment because that makes me sound like some kind of crazy radical.
But, I'll let you say environment.
I breathe air and stuff, so yeah.
Yeah. And then for you, career-wise?
Career-wise, well, I still get corporate work. There you go. It comes and goes. Through this, I've found that I really do enjoy documentary filmmaking quite a lot. So after this, I want to make another film.
Well, that's excellent.
Yeah.
That's great.
And it probably won't be about sand. Also, you know, I've got this itch to take some photographs of these mines. So I might try doing that too. They're hard to photograph.
Well, they're expansive, so.
Well,
yeah.
You know, the whole thing, did you see any of the aerial photographs
mm-hmm,
I took?
I did.
I went to Target and I bought a $300 camera. A GoPro?
I have a GoPro.
Camera. Everybody's got a GoPro, right.
You kidding?
Except
I love
Janet,
those things.
Janet doesn't have a GoPro.
They do
right.
Great in low light.
Well, and there's this guy, really nice guy, who retired, who owns a plane. He lives in Red Wing. He and his wife are involved in a group that's trying to stop the frac sand industry there. And his plane has I made a rig for it to mount a GoPro on the belly of the plane.
Nice.
And we had to do at least two flights because the vibration in a plane is really hard. And planes, you know, 100 miles an hour, easy. So you got all that wind.
Yeah.
And I tried a couple different cameras and I had this aluminum bracket with a suction cup and a whatever bolt. And in the end, I was able to get pretty good footage from the little GoPro. And then I actually took still frames out of that and distributed them. And what's crazy is those have ended up everywhere.
Yeah.
I mean, people have really used them a lot because an aerial perspective is really the best way to see the extent of these mines.
They're the huge. Whole picture. Well,
yeah.
Because you think about it, you're at the ground level with it, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you don't get the whole oversight of it, but then
right.
You look from a distance. It's kind of like, I like to compare it to Schindler's List when you're watching the movie and you see everybody who's died, but then you see the girl in the little red coat.
Right.
And you understand the impact of that
right.
that relationally, right?
Right.
So it's the same thing. I'm on the ground, but then I see the whole thing.
And the other thing, too, is that, and I noticed this, you know, go places. You know, you get real, you know, you're driving, you drive 4 or 5 hours, you get out of the car, you're tired. You look at it and you go, God, it just looks like a construction site.
Right.
We see construction sites all the time. So you have to find some way to frame it. And that's what it's about. It's about framing. And of course, conceptually, I'm trying to frame it with people's stories. And then now that I'm kind of getting towards the end of that, oh, that's the other thing. Whenever you think it's over, that, well, you know this. When you're done with a shoot and you're turning off the camera and wrapping the lights, then you hear the best stories.
Yeah, because people...
That's the rule of documentary filmmaking is never turn the camera off. Well, it's the same thing with this film. Now that I've basically wrapped, I'm hearing all these stories where I should go out and shoot more.
What's hard
but
to be done.
I
got to
finish the film. Right. Right.
So do you feel like you'll ever be done?
With this?
Yeah.
I think I probably have to be.
Yeah. Out of necessity.
Sure. Sure. I mean, life goes on.
Right. There's probably a million things you're like, well, I wish I could have done this or I wish I could have done that.
See, one thing I've done for years is, as a good person, you want to donate money to things or donate to stuff. Everybody's got some charity in them. In my case, I donate my time. Like, well, last year I went to Africa for 2 weeks and shot for free, shot a whole mess of stuff about this school. It's a school for orphans in Tanzania. And that was to raise money for the school. That's a long story, but I went and did this. I've done things for political campaigns that I believe in. I've done things for nonprofits, you know, they need a video to help raise money. And so this is one of those things, except to me, this was the scale of this was warranted by, this is my hometown. This is where my mom lives. This will directly impact people I love and a place I love. So it seemed like I should put more energy into it. But it's part of a whole series of things I've done. I don't generally give money to charities, but I do give my time. And I have skills, you know, and those skills they would pay money for.
I kind of end up doing the same thing.
Sure. Yeah, it's something, pro bono work is great. You can do it and feel good about it. Plus, you learn more about the cause that you're... I would just be in the Twin Cities worrying about this, reading, getting angry. And so now I know more about it.
If people want to do what you're doing...
Uh-huh.
What kind of advice would you have for them?
Oh, well, my advice is, first of all, get good audio. The picture can suck. Just get good audio. And you said that before we started here. Really, you know, here we are on the radio, but get good sound. Do what you have to get a good sound. And but really the advice is, I learned this working on Al Franken's campaign, you know, the volunteer video work that I did for Al. YouTube came back at us right away and they said, make your videos under 2 minutes and your viewership's going to go up. So I would say to anybody, if you want to use media for social change or action, learn how to make a rockin' 2-minute video, you know, a really good, interesting 2-minute video. I mean, make it honest. Don't cut to make people sound like they're something they're not or whatever, but just learn how to tell your story concisely and use YouTube. Because I think that's a really great vehicle for getting... I've been in meetings where people have... Public meetings where people have quoted my videos. They didn't even know I was there. But they've quoted things that they've seen on my YouTube channel.
That's pretty awesome.
It is. It is. I mean, you kind of feel a little warm inner glow. Like, oh, that really made a difference.
And... You kind of get celebrity status then, too.
I don't know, you know. That wouldn't be a good thing.
Well, if people want to get a hold of you, how do they do that? Because there's 8 million ways, isn't there?
Well, you know, actually, I have a YouTube channel. It's Minnehaha999, which was sort of just an arbitrary name I picked before I figured out what I was doing. But if you go to Minnehaha999, you can contact me, you know, through YouTube. And also there's a website, thepriceofsand.com, and there you can contact me that way by email. That's probably the best way. Well, I don't know why anybody would want to get a hold of me, but if you do, sure.
Well, thanks so much.
And there's also a Facebook. I'm sorry.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Too,
Facebook.
The Price of Sand on Facebook.
Twitter? No. Not with
Twitter.
The twit.
Twitter freaks me out. I don't know what to do with it.
You know, I don't know either. I can never.
You let me know, okay?
I've kind of abandoned it.
Okay.
I really have. All I've abandoned ship. Well, thanks for joining us.
Certainly.
I loved it.
You know, I was looking through all my releases. I got a stack of releases everybody's released. And there's a guy I shot over at Stout. He was nice enough to do some microscopy, you know, of crystalline silica. And on his release, he says, he signs it, and underneath he says in big letters, capitals, "Don't make me look like an idiot, please."
I hear what you're saying.
Yeah.
I hear what you're clucking, Big Chicken.
Yeah.
Well said.
Thank you again to Jim Tittle for visiting with us on ArtBeat. More information on Jim and his documentary, The Price of Sand, can be found at thepriceofsand.com. You've been listening to ArtBeat.
ArtBeat is written and produced by KQAL-FM on the campus of Winona State University. Visit us on the web at kqal.org.